that. My dad and Uncle Mike said if I ever told anyone, it was going to come. The anxiety in her voice rose higher until she was ranting. It's going to chew my arms and legs off. That's what's going to happen. No, sweet, I said, trying to pacify her. It's not going to come. You did your very best with the police. I know that. You were a good girl and nothing is going to hurt you. You're safe with me. You know that, don't you? There's no monster. As I tried to calm her, I realized that it was this fear that had stopped her from talking to the police. Instantly, my anger flared at the power the abusers still had over her. She was unwittingly protecting them because the terror they had planted in her was so strong that it overrode everything else. You're safe with me, Jodie, I said, as we headed for home. I promise. That night, when I turned on the 10 o'clock news, the screen was dominated by a rock star, arrested as part of a worldwide investigation into child pornography on the internet. The police had seized his computer and found images of children on the hard disk. I seethed with anger. How did these perverts think the photographs were obtained? For every image downloaded, a child had been abused and a life and personality destroyed. The end result was children like Jodie, fractured and hurt almost beyond repair. As far as I was concerned, the person buying this filth was just as responsible as the abuser, and I had no sympathy for his fall from grace or for the claim that he was researching a book. Our appointment with the psychologist was set for Monday afternoon. Although this was our first meeting with Dr. Burrows together, Jodie had seen her once before while she was with her second carers. For some reason, she seemed reluctant to see her again. "But Dr. Burrows will be able to help you," I explained. "Everyone wants to help you, Jodie, but first we have to tell Dr. Burrows what we know. You need to say what happened so that people can make it all better."
"None of her damn business," she snarled. "Nosy cow."
"What isn't her business?" I asked, but she wouldn't be drawn. I suspected her parents had warned her against this kind of thing and against cooperating, fearing that a psychologist would be a particular threat to their shameful secret. They needn't have worried. From the moment we arrived, Jodie was hostile and uncommunicative. She wouldn't answer any questions, not even on innocuous subjects like her favourite toys or what she liked to eat. The only answers she did give were monosyllabic or gibberish. Dr. Burrows was professional and businesslike and clearly knew how to connect with children, but she was making no progress with Jodie. After a while, she gave up trying to ask straightforward questions and tried a different approach. She brought out a pad of paper and some coloured pencils. "Jodie, would you be able to do some drawings for me? I'd like to see some pictures. How about drawing me a picture of your mum and dad at home?" This did seem to soften Jodie a little, and she took up a pencil and began to draw in her clumsy, malcoordinated way. We watched as she scrawled out a picture. I'm not a psychologist, but I was at a loss to see how her pictures could be of any use. They were childish pinmen drawings with oversized heads and no detail. Jodie, however, clearly felt that she had done more than enough, as all further questions from the doctor were met with,
"Don't know. Piss off."
At last the hour's session drew to a close. It felt as if it had been a bit futile, and I took the opportunity to ask the doctor if she could suggest anything to help me cope with Jodie's needs. "Her main need is primary care," she replied. "I can see you're performing that admirably. She'll respond to continuity and firm boundaries. I'm very pleased she's placed with you. You're doing an excellent job." Compliments are all well and good, but what I had actually asked for was advice. I felt exasperated and very isolated. I wasn't trained for this. I was just muddling through in the dark, beset by fatigue, confusion, and the sense of being hopelessly out of my depth. The tools and training I had just weren't sufficient for Jodie's needs, I realized now. The doctor was clearly excellent, but she didn't seem able to grasp that I couldn't divorce Jodie's primary care from her mental welfare. I dealt every day not just with feeding her, amusing her, and keeping her clean, but also with tantrums, violence, nightmares, waking visions, hallucinations, and abject terror. Those things couldn't be fitted nicely into a one-hour slot. I lived with them day and night. As we left, I felt more alone than I had in my life. Before I knew it, Christmas was only 10 days away, but my excitement of a few weeks ago was now hard to muster. It was going to be a low-key affair this year. I'd already bought and wrapped most of the presents and decorated the house, but my heart wasn't in it. I tried to put on a brave face for the sake of the children, but I'd scaled down the usual arrangements. I was simply too exhausted to cope with a full-scale celebration. My parents were coming for Christmas Day, along with my brother and his family. I usually had a small party for friends and neighbours on Christmas Eve, but it wasn't going to be feasible this year. I explained to them that I had rather a lot going on at the moment, and I'd have them round when things were calmer. I hoped no one was offended. In quieter moments, when I had time to reflect, I could see that I was becoming too involved in Jodie and her suffering. I was getting sucked into the abyss of her emotional turmoil. And although I was aware of it, I couldn't seem to shake it off. She occupied my thoughts continuously. When I tried to read a book, I would find myself turning the page without having followed any of the plot. It was the same with the radio or television. I was constantly preoccupied by Jodie, and my own state of mind was suffering. Her distorted perception was colouring mine. It felt as though the evil that had corrupted Jodie's world was creeping out and corrupting my home as well. There seemed to be a poison in the air, and Jodie was its innocent transmitter. I decided I needed a break to put things back in perspective. I called Jill. I explained to her that I was becoming physically and mentally exhausted. "Jill, I'm not kidding. I need a break. Just some time to regroup and get my strength back and think of something else for a bit. My own children could do with a bit of my time and attention as well. Could you look into arranging respite, please? Any weekend in January will be fine." "Of course," she replied. "You deserve a holiday. More than that, you need one if you're going to be able to stay the course. I'll look into it this afternoon. The only problem is, Kathy, I'll have to find carers who are up to it. They'll need to be very experienced, with no younger or similar-aged children. I can think of one couple in Surrey. I'll see if they're free." "Thank you. I'd be grateful." I put the phone down, my spirits lifting just a little. Chapter 18. Fire. The next day, Jill phoned to arrange her last visit before Christmas. We chatted for a while. Jill asked me if Jodie ever mentioned her brother and sister. "Occasionally," I replied, in the context of something she's telling me about home. "She doesn't ask to see them." "No, she doesn't." And it suddenly occurred to me how unusual this was. The bond between siblings in care is often strengthened by separation, so even if the children aren't seeing their parents, social services usually make sure that contact is arranged between the brothers and sisters. "Are there any plans for them to keep in touch?" I asked. "Not at present. There were concerns about Jodie's treatment of them. I think they had reason to believe that she could be a bit heavy-handed with them, which is why they all went to separate carers." I could imagine that. Jodie often lashed out when she was frustrated. "What about Christmas cards and presents?" I asked. "We can certainly pass them on if she wants to send them." That afternoon, I asked Jodie if she wanted to go Christmas shopping to buy presents for her brother and sister.
"No," she said. "Don't want to."
"How about sending a card? I'll help you write it if you like."
"No. Hate them."
"Why do you hate them, Jodie?" She thought for a moment.
"Mum liked them more than me. She took them away when Dad came into my bedroom."
"Okay, pet, I think I understand." I wasn't sure exactly what she was telling me, but it was quite possible that the younger ones had been protected in some way from what Jodie went through. No wonder she would resent them. Perhaps she'd even hit out at them because she was jealous of their escape and wanted to punish them. It was conjecture, of course, but I hoped for the other children's sakes that they had been left alone. Not only was Jodie cut off from her parents, she was also isolated from her siblings. With no grandparents in the picture and abusers for aunts and uncles, this meant we were the only family she had. I thought of my own children and the extended family who wouldn't hesitate to step in and look after them if anything happened to me. This wasn't such an issue now, but it had been a real concern in the past. My husband had left when Adrian was Jodie's age, and in the darker moments I'd welcomed the safety net of knowing that were I to fall under a bus, they would be loved and cared for just the same. Jodie, on the other hand, had no one in the world but us. Instead of shopping, Jodie wanted to do some painting, so I covered the table with paper and set out the paints, brushes and a pot of water. I tied Jodie's apron around her and left her for a few minutes to work on her masterpiece. When I came back to check on her, I was impressed. Jodie had produced a number of pictures which actually looked like something.
"Do you like them, Kathy?" Jodie asked proudly.
"I really do. These are excellent, Jodie. Can you describe them for me? Tell me what they are."
"All right. This one is a house."
"That's very nice. And those are the windows, aren't they?"
"Yes, windows. This one's a car, and this one's my dog. Stupid old dog."
I jolted to attention. At the pre-placement meeting, I'd been told that Jodie had set fire to her dog and had nearly burned her house down in the process. It was this incident that had finally led to her and her siblings being taken into care.
"I see," I replied. "Can you tell me more about the picture?" "Yes, I can. This is our dog, Sam. He's a big brown dog, always woofing."
"And why did you say he was stupid, Jodie?"
"I don't know," she replied impatiently.
"There must be a reason why he's stupid. You can tell me."
"He's all ugly and burnt. He's horrible."
"Oh, dear. How did he get burnt?" I asked, trying to keep my voice light and relaxed. We were still standing side by side looking at the pictures, and I was anxious not to put pressure on her. Jodie shook her brush in the water, then tested it on the paper. Finding it was still not clean, she dipped and shook it again. "Jodie, can you tell me how Sam got burnt? I promise I won't be angry."
"Jodie did it," she muttered. "I put all the bog roll on him, then used Mum's lighter. He was jumping and jumping and woofing and started running around and everything was burning."
"Where were your mum and dad when you did this?"
"They were at Uncle Mike's."
"Were you on your own?"
"No, Ben and Chessie was there."
Jodie's sister's name was Chelsea, but she had trouble pronouncing it.
"I was looking after them."
"So, what happened next?"
"I picked up Chessie and took her and Ben in the garden, and the stupid dog came and started rolling in the dirt. It looked all ugly with its hair hanging off, and it stinks, and it made a lot of noise. I went in the hall and dialed 999, and the fireman came and put it out."
"That was sensible, calling the fireman. You saved Chelsea and Ben."
"Yeah,"
she said, grabbing a fresh sheet of paper. "Jodie, can you tell me why you wanted to hurt your dog?"
"Wasn't my dog," she snapped. "Daddy's dog. I told you."
"Oh, right. Can you tell me why you wanted to hurt your daddy's dog?" Her brow furrowed in concentration. Gradually her face hardened and her fist clenched around the brush.
"I hate him. I hate them, and I wanted to burn the house down and get out. It's a horrible house."
She thumped the table.
"And I want my daddy arrested. He's horrible. He sat on my face. They should arrest him. Kill him."
"But why set fire to the dog, Jodie? Why not burn the curtains or the sofa if you wanted to burn the house down and get out?"
"You are silly. I get smacked if I mess up the settee. Can I have a biscuit now, Cathy?
While I got her a biscuit, I wondered if Jodie had set the dog alight as a way of punishing her father by hurting something he loved. Or perhaps, despite all her learning difficulties and developmental delays, Jodie had worked out a way to get herself out of that house. The frightening thought was that if she hadn't done what she did, she might still be there, undergoing that vile degradation day after day. In the days that followed, Jodie became increasingly distant. I renewed my efforts to draw her into the heart of our family, but she remained fiercely resistant, acting as if she needed no one and could manage alone. I'd seen this kind of behaviour before. Self-sufficiency is not unusual in abused or neglected children, as they've often had to be resilient in order to survive. But Jodie took it to a new level. Any expression of care or concern from us was met with outright rejection or sneered ridicule. She wanted no part of the daily support or interaction that made up family life, and erected barriers to emphasise her separateness. One afternoon, Paula and Lucy joined us for a shopping trip, but Jodie refused to walk with us. Instead, she walked 6 paces in front or behind and barely spoke a word. The next day I took Jodie to the cinema to see Lilo and Stitch, and she pointedly sat 2 seats apart from me. She only rejoined me when the lights went down, as she was scared of the dark. She'd never been to the cinema before, and she didn't show much excitement either before or afterwards. It was another sign of how dulled and desensitised she was. She basked in her loneliness, and I was completely at a loss to know how to break through. My only hope was that Christmas would strengthen our relationship. After all, there's nothing more family-oriented than Christmas. Chapter 19. Special Little Girl. Nicola came to give Jodie her last lesson before Christmas, and the following day the girls' school and Adrian's college both broke up. Suddenly the 5 of us were together all day. However, I use the term together loosely, for although we were under the same roof, togetherness was avoided, and not only by Jodie. Adrian, Paula and Lucy spent most of their time in their rooms, and when they did come down, they were met with a kick, a punch or a volley of, "What you doing? Get out! It's my house now!" and so on. Her attitude to the others had not softened much in her time with us. Illogically, the more attention I gave her, the more jealous she was of the others. I explained to Jodie over and over again that we all lived together as a family, but she wasn't open to reason. Even so, although she didn't want the family, it seemed that she did want me. Her possessiveness had been consolidated by the weeks when there had been just the 2 of us during the day, and I was starting to resent it. She demanded my constant attention, and I saw that she was doing what no other child had done before, undermining the fabric of our family. Normally, I would have dealt with this by trying to put some distance between us, but this was virtually impossible with Jodie because of the high level of her needs. Jodie's hostility and aggression had a powerful effect on everyone in the house and created an unpleasant atmosphere. Even when she was up in her room, we could feel it in the house, like a malevolent presence. At dinner, on the occasions when we did all eat together, I would have to carry the conversation, as the children had become inhibited by Jodie's endless snapping and kept quiet. We were even looking at each other less, because if any of us looked in Jodie's direction, this was liable to set her off. One glance could quickly lead to a tantrum, and no one wanted to be responsible, however indirectly, for ruining yet another meal. We were also communicating with each other less, as the nature of Jodie's abuse meant that we were limited to a very narrow range of conversation. We couldn't, for instance, discuss Lucy's new boyfriend, even though he was pretty much the only thing on her mind. In fact, men of all ages had become effectively taboo in our house. We were even wary of discussing pop stars on TV. With the girls at home, I became acutely aware of the physical distance that Jodie had created between herself and the rest of the family. In the first few months after her arrival, Jodie had needed lots of hugs and comfort, but recently she had cut out almost all physical contact, even when she woke screaming in the night. I was always hugging and kissing the girls, and to a lesser degree Adrian, and this made it immediately apparent how isolated Jodie had become. I tried to remedy this, of course, but when I tried to hug her before she went up to bed, or asked her to sit next to me on the sofa, she would make a joke of being disgusted, and either shake her head or simply run away. I was always upset when she did this, because it was clear that she was terribly sad and lonely, and I wanted nothing more than to show her the affection and love that my children took for granted. I'm no psychologist, but my guess was that the legacy of abuse had tarnished physical contact in her mind and made it uncomfortable and frightening. It was an awful catch-22. Jodie needed affection more than anyone I'd ever known, but the means by which affection is communicated would only contribute to her anxiety. Sally, the guardian ad litem, came to visit and asked to spend some time alone with Jodie. I left the two of them in the lounge and took the opportunity to spend some time with Lucy and Paula while Adrian was out with his friends. Jodie had been disruptive and aggressive all morning, and I found Paula sitting despondently on her bed.
"I wish I was back at school," she admitted. "I'm dreading Christmas. She'll ruin it."
"No, she won't. We won't let her. And we may find it's just what she needs to open her heart. I know it's difficult, but she can't keep this up forever."
"Can't she? She's done a good job so far. I daren't even bring my friends home because of how she is."
I was taken aback. My usually sociable daughter was now too embarrassed to bring friends home. I went over and hugged her.
"I'm sorry. I didn't realise. How about you arrange a sleepover when she's away on respite? Videos, midnight feast, the lot."
She brightened a little.
"Okay, Mum. I'm sorry."
"No need to apologise. I understand."
I went into Lucy's room, but the second I mentioned Jodie's name, she turned on me.
"It's all we ever talk about, Jodie, bloody Jodie. I'm sick to death of her. I wish she'd never come. You won't change her, Kathy, whatever you do. Surely you can see that by now. She's evil. She needs a bloody priest, not a carer."
I wondered if Sally had noticed the tension in the house, for as she was about to leave, she paused in the hall and placed her hand on my arm.
"Kathy, you're doing a really good job, but make sure you and your family don't suffer. These children can play havoc with your emotions. Remember, her damage isn't your responsibility. You can only do so much."
I found Sally's words comforting. It was nice to hear someone say something positive and to recognise what was going on. I respected Sally. She managed to combine professionalism with an ability to empathise that made me feel she understood. Later that afternoon, Eileen phoned.
"Hello, Kathy," she said in her flat, plodding way. "We've got a bit of a problem."
"Oh, yes," I replied, unperturbed. I was used to social workers telling me we had problems. It usually meant that something unpleasant was coming my way.
"When we sent a copy of the doctor's letter to Jodie's parents, someone forgot to blank out your details, so I'm afraid they sent them your name and address."
As usual, she didn't sound very sorry at all. I was furious. I'd been worrying about the ear, nose and throat department being indiscreet, but meanwhile the social services had been handing out my details. I thought back to the silent phone call I'd received when Nicola had been with us. Could that have been Jodie's parents?
"I see," I said. "That's really going to make Jodie feel safe. I can't say I'm surprised, though. When did it happen?"
"I'm not sure exactly. We only found out when Jodie's mother phoned today, demanding contact. She threatened to come to your house if we didn't arrange it. Obviously, we told her that was unacceptable, but I thought you should know."
"Thanks," I said tersely. "And what did she say? Is she still planning on coming round?"
"I don't think so. She only mentioned it once, but don't worry, if she does come round, we'll apply for an injunction straight away."
"Yes," I thought, "but an injunction's only a piece of paper." I'd had angry parents turning up on my doorstep before, and I knew waving a scrap of paper at them wouldn't have had much of an effect.
If a child is on a voluntary care order or we're working towards rehabilitating the child so that he or she can go back home and the parents are cooperating, then there's no problem in them knowing where the child and I live. Indeed, sometimes contact takes place in my house. But that clearly wasn't the case here, far from it. It was blindingly obvious that the highest level of care should have been taken to protect my details, and that hadn't happened. Eileen was impervious to my frustration, and there wasn't much I could do about the situation now. An injunction was as useful as locking the stable door after the horse had bolted. "Right," I said stiffly. "Thanks for letting me know," and ended the call. I was angry, of course, but, as I'd said to Eileen, I wasn't terribly surprised. While the care proceedings are in progress, there are a huge number of documents flying around between the parents, solicitors, social workers, the guardian ad litem and others. The present system relies on someone in the office at social services remembering to blank out the confidential details from every document, so it's inevitable that there will be mistakes. In my experience, about 50% of parents are given my address at some point, which in my view is unacceptable. As a result, when there is a breach of confidentiality, we as a family have to take special precautions. My children always look through the spy hole before answering the door, and if it's someone they don't recognise, they don't open it. Instead, they fetch me. Foster children don't answer the door at all. On top of this, we have an expensive alarm system, a chub lock, and I always look up and down the road before leaving the house. After a while, it becomes second nature, and we have all learned that we simply have to accept the risks. Thank goodness that, apart from some nasty verbal confrontations, none of us has been placed in real danger. My patience with Eileen, however, was stretched to the limit a few days later. For reasons known only to themselves, social services decided to call a meeting to discuss Jodie's mother's threat to come round, and they wanted Jill and me to attend. We marvelled that they had the time so close to Christmas. And what were we going to discuss in any case? No one could take back the information now that it had been released. Taking out an injunction forbidding Jodie's parents to come near my property would have been pointless. The only other option was to move Jodie to new carers, which was clearly in no one's interests, especially not Jodie's. And who would take her anyway, with her complex needs and at such short notice? The meeting went as I had expected. We discussed all the possible options before deciding on the sensible course, namely, to do nothing. I was relieved to get out of there and was just shaking my head at the monumental waste of time we'd all been through when Eileen caught up with me in the corridor. "Kathy, just before you go, can I give you this? It's a Christmas present for Jodie. Her father asked me to pass it on to her." I stared at her, astonished, as she held out a well-used Tesco carrier bag. "I'm not sure it's really appropriate, Eileen," I said with forced diplomacy and reminding myself of my professionalism. "Contact has been suspended, and present giving is usually classified as contact, particularly in a case like this. Jodie feels very hostile towards her parents at the moment, understandably." "Oh, right," she replied, mulling this over. "Do you want me to give it back then?" As she said this, she pulled the unwrapped present out of the bag, presumably to show me how harmless it was and that I was being overcautious. It was a bright pink long-sleeved T-shirt with Daddy's Little Girl printed on the front in big sparkly letters. Eileen looked at it, then held it up. "So you don't think Jodie would like it?" she said. I was almost lost for words as I looked at her holding up a T-shirt that was just about the most bitterly ironic thing I'd ever seen. "Eileen," I said slowly and deliberately, "Jodie has been sexually abused by her father, probably for most of her life. I don't think a T-shirt calling her Daddy's Little Girl is very appropriate. Do you? If I gave her this, Jodie would be terrified by the sight of it." The penny dropped. "Oh, yes, right, I take your point. We'll give it back then. Have a lovely Christmas." By the time I reached my car, I was still shaking my head in astonishment. Chapter 20. Christmas. I was determined to make sure Jodie enjoyed Christmas and started to feel part of the family. I knew from sad experience that foster children have often missed out on Christmas in the past. In fact, because they're at home for at least 2 whole days and their parents tend to drink more, it can be the worst time of year for many children. I remembered my previous placement, Callum, a sweet-natured 10-year-old. Callum had lived with his mother, who was a non-functioning alcoholic. That meant that she was incapable of leading a normal life. She was too locked into the prison of her alcohol dependency. The Christmas before Callum came to me, his father had sent him a cheque, which his mother had subsequently taken and spent on drink. On Christmas Day, she'd woken up after midday with a hangover and then tried to make Christmas dinner. She hadn't done any shopping, so she peeled the breadcrumbs off some chicken nuggets and tried to pass it off to Callum as roast turkey. Despite her drink problem, Callum's mother hadn't been violent or abusive towards him, but her alcoholism had been such that Callum had had to look after her, rather than vice versa. For the previous 3 years, he hadn't had a single Christmas or birthday present. The Christmas he spent with us, I bought him a skateboard, helmet and knee pads, and when he opened them, he ran out of the room because he didn't want us to see him cry. On Christmas morning, Jodie was up before 6, as usual, but she seemed to regard it as just another day. The previous night, we had all hung pillowcases on our doors, and these were now full of presents. I led Jodie downstairs and showed her that the glass of sherry, mince pie and carrots had all disappeared, which meant that Father Christmas had come to visit in the night.
"That's nice, Cathy,"
she replied, as if humouring me. Throughout the morning, even as we opened up the presents under the tree, Jodie remained fairly flat, but she did seem to have some understanding of the importance of the day. She behaved well and generally joined in with the family. As I watched her, I hoped that even though she wasn't showing much enthusiasm, the goodwill of the day was having some impact and that she would remember it fondly in the future. In the afternoon, my parents arrived, along with my brother Tom, his wife Chloe, and their 6-year-old Ewan. Suddenly the house was full of noise and excitement, and I realised how cut off we had all become from our normal lives. For one thing, I hadn't had any adult company for more than a week. Jodie had met all of my family before, when they had come round to visit me in the usual run of things, and they always included the children I fostered, treating them like members of the family. Nonetheless, she seemed a little startled when they all arrived at once, and she remained inhibited for most of the day. After I'd made a round of drinks, we all gathered together in the lounge, ready to exchange presents. My family had brought some for us, and we had kept theirs under the tree, ready and waiting. We were all excited, but I could see that this was another ritual which was new to Jodie. As the presents were handed out, she stared at the others, taking cues on how to behave. She watched Ewan as he opened a present and then followed suit. She looked at it blankly and I had to coax her to show excitement.
"That's lovely, Jodie, isn't it? You can play with that this afternoon. Will you say thank you?"
She did as she was told, but without any of the excitement and shining eyes that Christmas usually brought to children. Throughout the day, she didn't seem ungrateful for what she was given, and she did seem to like some of her gifts, but it was sad to see her having to mimic the enthusiasm and happiness that came naturally to the others. After dinner, we sat around and played games as we slowly recovered from the meal. The girls worked hard to include Jodie, but she grew irritable, perhaps worn out by the excitement of the day. She went through the motions of playing the various games, but didn't seem to derive any pleasure from them. When she didn't win, she became angry and slammed her fist on the arm of the sofa. When she did win, she was flat. She couldn't take any pleasure from it and couldn't celebrate gregariously with the others. When we cheered for her, she joined in, but it seemed hollow. Sometime later, she seemed to become frustrated and started holding her nose. I ignored it at first, suspecting that she was simply seeking attention, but when she persisted, I eventually asked what was wrong.
"My nose hurts," she said, her voice muffled by her hand.
"Oh, dear," I replied. "Can I have a look?" She removed her hand but squirmed away when I tried to touch her face. "I can't see anything wrong. Is there anything I can do?"
"It hurts," she moaned.
"Why does it hurt, Jodie? Have you done something to it?"
"It hurts!"
She was getting louder and did seem to be in pain.
"OK, well, come with me and we'll put a cold flannel on it."
I took her into the bathroom and put the wet flannel to her face. "Can you tell me what you did, Jodie, to make it hurt?"
"It was him! He whacked me in the face!"
"Who, Jodie?"
"Daddy! He thumped me!"
she wailed, sounding like she was about to cry. I'd been sitting next to her in the living room, so I knew that nothing had actually happened. However, even though the pain seemed to be imagined, in the sense that she obviously hadn't been injured today, it was totally real to her. It sounded like she was remembering being hurt in the past and was transposing the memory onto the present. We stood in the bathroom for a while until she'd calmed down, then we went back to the lounge to rejoin the others. At 8 o'clock, we stood on the doorstep and waved as my parents and my brother's family drove off home. I closed the front door. I was relieved that Christmas was over, even though it had gone as well as I could have hoped. Jodie had been somewhat overawed by the occasion and the large gathering, but she had behaved reasonably, and I hoped that some of the warmth of the season had got through to her. While it hadn't proved a breakthrough and hadn't touched Jodie emotionally in the way that Callum had been touched, I hoped that Christmas would now mean something good to Jodie, and that she'd had a small taste of what other children enjoyed every year. Chapter 21 A New Year. As the new year approached, my spirits rose. A new year offers a new start, and anything seems possible on the 1st of January. Giving up smoking, however, was not on my list of resolutions, and I was now sneaking outside upwards of 7 times a day, deluding myself that I would quit again when things were calmer. But when on earth would that be? Despite my hopes, Jodie showed no improvement as the new year passed. Her behaviour continued to be difficult and hostile, and her nights were increasingly disturbed by nightmares and hallucinations. She was having more incidences of remembered pain now, and these became linked to disclosures. Jodie would complain that her arm hurt, and this would lead to the memory of her mother hitting her with an ashtray, or her father scalding her with hot water. In all of these cases, Jodie's pain seemed to be completely genuine, despite my attempts to explain to her that the injury she was describing had happened months, sometimes years ago. Although I didn't think she was fabricating the remembered pain, I was becoming increasingly aware that she was lying in other situations. Often she was so convincing that I found myself questioning what I'd seen and doubting the evidence of my own eyes. If I caught her red-handed in the middle of some misdemeanour, she would so emphatically deny that it was happening that I had to stop and reassess what I was looking at. She had sometimes told lies when she first arrived, but I'd assumed that she had been reverting to past experience, telling lies to avoid punishment, so it had been somewhat understandable. Now, however, she must have known that she didn't have to worry, that there was never any risk of her being physically or emotionally punished. Why, then, did she feel it necessary to deny her actions so vehemently? She also started making false accusations, making up stories about the other children, even when I was in the room and had obviously seen that nothing had happened. She would claim Lucy or Paula had kicked, pinched or bitten her, which was clearly ludicrous. If anything, they were scared of her, quite understandably. When I pointed out to her that I'd been in the room the whole time and had seen that no one had gone near her, she flared up.
"She did! She did! Why don't you ever believe me?"
She was so passionate and convincing, I was often tempted to reconsider and had to remind myself of what I'd seen. At other times, I caught her deliberately hurting herself. It wasn't like the time she had cut herself so chillingly. Now it seemed more as though it was done in anger, in a fit of fury or passion, when she would thump herself, pinch herself, thud her head against something or pull her hair. Then she blamed it on one of her imaginary friends. Some friend, I thought. I would have to patiently tell her that actually she was the one who was doing it, as no one else had touched her. This self-harming was one of the most disturbing aspects of Jodie's behaviour, and the pinches, scratches and thumps she inflicted sometimes produced marks, which she then used to convince herself even further that someone had been attacking her. Even more worrying, a week into the new year, the different voices she sometimes used began to suddenly take on identities of their own. Adrian's mobile phone went missing, and after a lengthy search I eventually found it in Jodie's toy box, which was on a shelf in the conservatory. Jodie hadn't stolen anything before, but she did have problems respecting other people's property, and I had been trying to teach her that we couldn't just help ourselves to what we wanted, that we had to ask the owner first.
"It wasn't me, honestly," she repeated,
looking me straight in the eyes and speaking in a babyish voice.
"It really wasn't. I'm not big enough to reach."
Adrian and I both looked at the shelf on which Jodie had just placed the toy box with ease.
"Of course you are," said Adrian. "It's just above your waist."
"No," she insisted, heightening her baby voice. "It was her."
She pointed to the space beside her.
"It was Jodie."
"You're Jodie," I said wearily.
"No, I'm Amy. I'm only 2 and I can't reach."
She rubbed her eyes and pouted like a toddler. I told her again that she mustn't take Adrian's mobile and left it at that. A day later, the separation of her personality took on another, more sinister form. She was up at 5:30 in the morning, so I went in to settle her. She was sitting on the bed playing with her music box and clapping loudly. "Quietly, Jodie," I said. "Find something to do that's quiet if you've had enough sleep." She spun round to face me. Her features were hard and distorted.
"No,"
she shouted, in a gruff, masculine voice.
"Get out or I'll rip you to pieces. Get out, bitch."
I instinctively took a step back. "Jodie, don't use that word. Now calm down. Find something to do quietly. I mean it. Now." She stood and brought herself to her full height. She advanced towards me with her hands clawed, baring her teeth.
"I'm not Jodie," she growled. "I'm Reg. Get out or I'll fucking kill you."
I wasn't going to tackle her in that mood. I closed the door and waited on the landing. My heart was racing. I heard her pacing the floor, cursing my name along with the rest of the families.
"Wankers! Evil wankers! I'll rip their heads off!"
She growled again and then it went quiet. I opened the door and looked in. Jodie was in bed looking calmly at a book. Apparently, the old Jodie had returned. As a foster carer, I'd seen some pretty extreme behaviour in children, and to a certain extent I was used to it. But not this extreme. This was new. Jodie's imaginary friends seemed to be taking over. "Who's Reg?" I asked later that morning as we emptied the dishwasher together. Jodie looked up at me uncomprehendingly. "Do you know someone called Reg? I thought you mentioned his name when I came into your room first thing this morning." She shook her head and carried on sorting the cutlery.
"There's someone on Mum's telly called Reg, but he's horrible. I don't talk to him."
"And there's no one else you know called Reg?"
"No."
And I believed her. Reg, like Amy, seemed to have taken on a life of his own without Jodie's knowledge or consent. When I told Jill about this, she was very surprised. "This is highly unusual, but if I'm right, then it sounds like DID, Dissociative Identity Disorder. DID is a rare and complex response to stress," she explained, "where the personality splits into a number of different identities in order to cope. Often, one identity has no idea what the others are doing." "That sounds exactly what she's doing," I said. "It's very unnerving. Why is she doing it with us? It hasn't happened before. Why would it start happening now when she's more secure than she's ever been? Perhaps it's because it's only now that she feels safe enough to remember the abuse. I suspect that before, she wasn't even able to accept and process what was happening to her. She blotted it out in order to survive. You said that she was very calm and accepting at first. Remember how she passively began to take her clothes off when you wanted to photograph her? There was no fight in her, because she needed to keep going. However, now that she's removed from the abuse, she can start recalling it and piecing together what happened. I told her about the remembered pain and how real it seemed to Jodie. That makes sense as well, said Jill. She couldn't afford to feel the pain at the time, so she's feeling it now. She's receiving an onslaught of information, physical and mental. Because she's remembering all these awful things, her brain's on overload and can't cope. By splitting her awareness, at least part of the self can be kept safe. So far, you've seen baby Amy and an angry adult male. Does she have an adult female side as well? Now I come to think of it, yes. I thought she was just imitating her mother, but now I'm not so sure. She tries to chastise Lucy and Paula as an angry housewife. Does she refer to her by name? Not that I've heard, no. It's the classic form, baby, adult female and adult male. We've all got these components in our personality, but when we're mentally healthy, they're all rolled into one. Jill paused. To be honest, I'm really worried. I was now feeling extremely concerned myself. Jodie, it seemed, was reacting to the terrible things that had happened to her. I had no idea what to expect or if I would be able to cope with the fallout of her extraordinary emotional trauma. Jill asked, "Have you told Eileen?" "No, she's been out of the office recently. I'll try and get through to her and make the psychologist aware of this. If I'm right, this is a severe personality disorder." "Jill," I asked tentatively as something occurred to me, "when she's in one of these states, can she do things that she wouldn't normally do? I mean, this Reg seems like a very angry character, and she seems to be quite strong when she's being him. If she was any bigger, I'd be getting her out of there. Adults with DID can assume superhuman strength and do things they wouldn't normally. But presumably you could restrain her if necessary, even when she's Reg?" I paused. "I think so." "And you want to continue?" "Yes." The further along this road I went, the more impossible it seemed to turn back. Now I know what it is, it doesn't seem quite so intimidating. Good. It's really quite interesting, you know. Interesting for Jill, maybe, with her ability to assess the situation at one remove. For me, well, interesting wasn't quite the word. That afternoon, I sat Adrian, Paula and Lucy down and explained what Jill had said. They stared at me, open-mouthed. "Jodie's got several personalities who possess her at different times," said Adrian, trying to get it straight in his mind. "And she has no idea that she's doing it." I nodded. It sounded crazy. "Bonkers," said Lucy. "Stark raving bonkers. She's totally off her trolley." Paula laughed. "I think I'll be the Queen of Sheba, and you can all wait on me and bring me gifts." I smiled. "It's not an act, though, darling. She doesn't choose this. It just happens. It's her mind's way of dealing with what she's been through."
"Will she be getting therapy?" Adrian asked, aware that she had seen a psychologist.
They all looked at me for an answer. "Not until the assessments are complete, which won't be until nearer the final court hearing. Jill says this condition can pass of its own accord, and in the meantime the best advice is to ignore it. There's no point in challenging her because, as we've seen, she can't remember what the other characters have said or done." So we tried to ignore it and carry on, in the hope that it would pass, but now it escalated. 3 or 4 times a day, baby Amy, angry Reg, or the nameless female matriarch suddenly took over and obliterated Jodie. It was often a very sudden change, usually lasting 10 to 15 minutes. Not only would Jodie's voice changed, but each personality had its own type of body language. When she was in character as Reg, she would draw herself up to her full height, shoulders back, chest out, making herself big and masculine. As Amy, she cowered and her face was babyish and pouting. Her angry housewife stood aggressively, with short, angry movements and an unpleasant grimace. The change would occur in an instant and revert just as suddenly when Jodie returned. When baby Amy appeared at dinner, Paula couldn't resist cutting up her food and feeding her.
"I've never had a baby sister," she grinned as she wiped Jodie's chin.
Conversely, when angry Reg took over, we all ran for cover, and knowing what the problem was did help, even though anyone watching would probably have thought we were the ones who were stark raving bonkers. I informed both Eileen and the psychologist of this new and disturbing facet of Jodie's mental health, but heard nothing from either of them. I could understand it in the psychologist's case. It wasn't her role to offer me advice or therapy tips, but I was disappointed that Eileen still wasn't able to offer any support or even show much interest, although by now I didn't expect anything different. It was just another small piece of Jodie's tragedy that she had been assigned a social worker who was, to say the least, ineffectual. Jill remained highly supportive, and the best we could do was just to hope that things would somehow get better. The spring term began, and to my utter relief, the secretary at Abbey Green School finally phoned to confirm that funding had been approved, and Jodie could start the following Monday. She suggested we visit the school on the Friday afternoon so that Jodie could spend some time with her class and get to know her support teacher. I wondered whether to tell her about the DID. Should I try to warn her about Jodie's erratic and bizarre behaviour? Would the school even have heard of DID? I decided not to mention it. They had Jodie's statement of educational needs, and if anything untoward happened, I was sure they'd call me. Besides, I wanted Jodie to start with a clean slate. Now that Jodie had a school place, there was no further need for a home tutor. Nicola phoned to wish Jodie luck and say goodbye, and Jodie spoke sensibly to her for a good 20 minutes. After she hung up, she came over to me solemnly.
"Nicola is a good adult, isn't she, Kathy?"
"Yes, sweet, she is. Most adults are, as you'll discover." Jodie nodded thoughtfully. I felt a spark of hope. Perhaps she was taking tiny, slow but definite steps towards being able to regain her trust in adults. Later that day, Jodie's social worker, Eileen, paid us a visit, her second in almost 10 months. Predictably enough, it went much like the first and was not a success. Jodie was hostile from the start, and Eileen had great difficulty relating to her. It is usual to leave the social worker and child together so that they can talk privately, but each time I tried to busy myself away from the lounge, one of them would immediately call me back in. Jodie would want another drink or a jigsaw or the television turned on, or Eileen would want to ask something trivial. For some reason, Eileen seemed to want me there. I suspected she was anxious or possibly even afraid of Jodie. After going back and forth a number of times, I decided I might as well join them, so I sat down with Jodie and tried to get her to calm down and speak more quietly. A quarter of an hour later, Eileen picked up her briefcase and, with a tight-lipped smile, left. She had done her duty.
"Good riddance," said Jodie,
and slammed the door behind her. I didn't disagree. Chapter 22 The Fox and the Owl. It was mid-January. After a brief lull, the weather had turned bitterly cold, and we had 3 full days of snow. Jodie relished the excitement, and on the few occasions when I couldn't immediately take her out into the snow, she would gaze out of the window, transfixed. The children's moods had lifted too. Now that they were back at school, they seemed to have found a new burst of empathy for Jodie. Paula, in particular, appeared to have benefited from venting her frustrations before Christmas. We hadn't actually arranged the sleepover yet, but she had had a number of friends round and had made a point of encouraging Jodie to join in as part of the group, bless her. One such afternoon, Paula's friend Olivia came for lunch, and they decided to go for a walk in the snow. My street is on the rim of a large valley, and the views are quite spectacular. Jodie pouted when she realised they were leaving, so Paula asked if Jodie and I would like to join them. Jodie was thrilled, so the four of us wrapped ourselves in coats, scarves and boots and headed out. As we walked up towards the high street, Paula and I each took one of Jodie's hands as the pavement was icy. However, despite our best efforts, Jodie kept slipping over, each time falling on her bottom. The third time it happened, she remained sitting on the pavement. She crossed her arms, rolled her eyes, and sighed theatrically. "Here we go again!" Paula and I grinned at each other in delight. Jodie's usual response to this kind of adversity would have been a bitter tirade.
"Who put that bloody ice there? Why are they doing that to me? It's your fault, hate you," and so on.
Instead, she'd seen the funny side and actively made an effort to try to make us laugh. It might not sound like much, but for us it felt like progress, and we joined in gratefully. Jodie's first day of school was approaching, so I took her shopping for her new school uniform. We bought two navy skirts, two jumpers with the school logo printed on them, and three white short-sleeved shirts. Jodie had behaved well in the shop, enjoying the attention, but she became angry when I opted for knee-length socks rather than tights. She wanted to have tights like Lucy and Paula wore, but I knew she'd have difficulty putting them on again after P.E. In the end, I came up with a sensible compromise and bought Jodie a pair of white lacy tights that she could wear at weekends. As we arrived home, Jill phoned and told me apologetically that the couple she had been considering for respite wouldn't be able to do it. Reason left unstated. "Great," I said tetchily. "I'm promised regular breaks because of the high level of Jodie's needs, but because of that high level of needs, it's impossible to find a carer." "I'm sorry, Kathy. I'll keep looking." "Yes, please do. Outside the agency, if necessary." What I meant by this was that Jill should approach a different fostering agency for a carer. This wasn't ideal, as standards varied, and the carers could be some distance away, but it was only one weekend, and I needed a break. On the Friday of that week, we'd arranged a visit to Jodie's new school. The visit wasn't till the afternoon, but Jodie was up early as usual, and she immediately got dressed in her new uniform. I didn't think this was a good idea, but I was anxious to avoid any unnecessary confrontation, so I let her keep it on and tucked an apron round her while she ate. Despite my efforts, by the time she'd had her breakfast and lunch, her uniform contained a good helping of both. I sponged off the stains as best I could, and we arrived at the school gates looking reasonably smart for the afternoon session. Abby Green hadn't been my first choice, but as we arrived, I was immediately impressed. The small carpeted reception area was bright and welcoming, and the smiling receptionist greeted us warmly. "Hello there, Jodie. It's very nice to meet you," she said, and then phoned through to the head, who appeared with courteous promptness. "Adam West," he said, shaking my hand.